Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. On Monday, we'll honor Martin Luther King Jr., whose work on civil rights was one of the turning points of the 20th century in America. But King in his time was a wholly divisive figure, unloved by millions of Americans, particularly white Americans, who despised him for his righteous opposition to white supremacy and for his holding up a mirror to American history and our violent realities. The same government that eventually cooperated with some of Martin Luther King's legislative agenda also tried to end his public life. J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI went to fantastic lengths to disgrace Dr. King, to get him off the political map once and for all. This FBI effort is the subject of a new documentary film called MLK, FBI. Here's Jelani Cobb, a staff writer and a historian.
As we see in the film, the FBI opened a dossier on Dr. King in 1955, purportedly out of concern that the movement had been infiltrated by people with ties to the Communist Party. But as the movement grew and developed, the FBI's tactics switched from mere surveillance to an active campaign to discredit King and his work. The film was directed by Sam Pollard, whose documentaries on American history go back to his work on Eyes on the Prize, the series from the late 1980s. So can you talk about how the surveillance of Dr. King began?
The surveillance began around when King started to become a nationally prominent figure in the late 50s, early 60s. Now, remember, the FBI started a thing called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence programming, where they were surveilling and wiretapping, you know, and eavesdropping on people who they thought were dangerous. I mean, it went beyond King. It was also Malcolm X. It was the Nation of Islam. It would later be the Black Panther Party. It would be Angela Davis. Any party they thought that they felt was going to change the status quo of America, they wanted to surveil and keep constant vigilance over. J. Edgar Hoover and William Sullivan saw him as a terrorist, a domestic terrorist. Mm. And they felt like what he was doing, you know, was going to change what America was supposed to be like. I mean, the America of the 40s and 50s, during the time of segregation and Jim Crow, here's America where Black people are on the periphery. And now all of a sudden you have this leader, you know, who developed his reputation from the Montgomery bus boycott, basically saying America needs to integrate. They need to recognize Black people. And this was absolutely frightening to Hoover and Sullivan and to basically many white Americans. I mean, if you go back and you look at the film, there's the television show that King's on and the white journalist says to him,
"What excuse or what reason do you offer for this approach of creating a crisis atmosphere in a community, which leads to bloodshed, as it has in many southern cities and some northern?"
Well, I think we should see the source of the bloodshed first, and we must understand the real nonviolent creed.
Well, doesn't this crisis atmosphere, though, create or endanger the Negroes' cause by creating among the whites a resentment, a feeling that the Negro is moving too rapidly, asking too much so suddenly? Does this worry you that this atmosphere could be created or is?
Well, I think this is a temporary response in any social revolution.
Or doesn't it hurt your cause?
I don't think so.
It's kind of an astounding moment, you know.
It's astounding, man.
The sheer number of times where you see King being accused of creating the problem simply by highlighting that, you know, segregation is immoral.
It's amazing. But you know what's sad about it, though, is you fast forward to today and you think back to the campaigning of Donald J. Trump. And what's he saying, you know, Jelani? He's saying to his group of people, you should be frightened because these people, these radical people on the left are going to come into your suburbs and destroy your community. You know, code words for Black people. You know, and then communism has been switched to Antifa, you know. But, you know, they're going to destroy democracy.
Or socialism,
you know,
right.
Yeah, the radical left.
Mm-hmm. You know, James Comey, the former FBI director and it kind of embattled figure in American politics during the course of the Trump administration, makes an appearance in this film. And I was a little bit surprised to see him. And could you tell me about how that came about and why you thought it was significant to have him involved?
Well, about 2.5 years ago, my producer, Ben Hedin, who I had worked with on a previous film, said, you know, why don't we reach out to James Comey, see if he would do an interview? I said, you really think he will? All the stuff, all the turbulence he had gone through with the Trump administration and being fired. And he felt like he just wanted to set the record straight about his feelings about the FBI back then and the importance of the FBI, to remind him of the FBI's past, the letter to that basically suggesting that King should kill himself.
Unbelievable. In the film, you have a clip with James Comey, describes how he felt the first time he actually read that letter.
I was sick to my stomach, actually. I mean, I didn't throw up, but I felt ill reading it. And that's what I mean when I say I think this entire episode represents the darkest part of the Bureau's history.
And you also have Andrew Young, who worked closely with King at the SCLC, and he recalls the moment where Coretta Scott King got that package at her home.
It was put in a box and sent to Coretta. So she opened it up and she played it. And then she called the office and said, look, somebody has sent a tape in here trying to get Martin to kill himself. And they have a recording of some man and woman in the bed. I didn't even want to hear it, you know. This was designed to upset him. We always assumed that Hoover was behind it. My philosophy about the movement is that unless I saw something with my own eyes, you really have to be careful what you believe.
It's something that people who've studied this, I think, know fairly well, that these things happened. But it's still a pretty amazing thing to think that this happened under the auspices of the federal government.
It's appalling where they would sit down and create a letter supposedly from a black person. You know what to do. I mean, this could really just try to destroy his marriage. It's really appalling. Mm. One of the horrific things was that Hoover was enabled to be in power for so long. I mean, he became like a dictator. I mean, nobody can be in power that long.
Yeah, yeah. He essentially ran the FBI for nearly half a century until he died in 1972. You also talked to Beverly Gage, who is a Hoover biographer.
One of the most important things that Hoover did was to create a bureau really in his own image. That meant that he hired a very particular kind of person as an agent, a relatively conservative white man of a certain height and a certain weight. He particularly liked fraternity boys and football players.
What do you make of J. Edgar Hoover's single-minded fixation with Martin Luther King?
I think the rationale, his obsession, was the fact that his brain was saying, how dare a black man is trying to change what America's, the America that I grew up in, that the America that he knew and loved was on a road to change, and he was totally against it. And his first obsession was with the Communist Party, which again he thought was going to destroy the fabric of American democracy. And then when he felt that the King was associated with that, how could he? And then when he learned that King was not, this upright Christian man, he felt that he was a disgrace to his robes. He was a disgrace to the community, and he wanted to destroy it.
And there were attempts to kind of filter this through the media.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But the media didn't bite back then. I mean, it's different. It was a different world. Mm-hmm. They respected people's personal and private lives. Mm-hmm. As they don't do today.
Yeah.
What really also happened, too, is they were surveilling King constantly. And King's agenda started to change, and he became part of the anti-Vietnam movement. Then J. Edgar Hoover was able to get the support of LBJ, who had been a close ally of King before. But then when King basically at the Riverside Church gave that speech, opposing the Vietnam War, then all of a sudden he became pariah to the LBJ administration.
I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam.
One of the things I take from your film is the astounding amount of pressure, the almost unbearable amount of pressure that King must have been under. You know, because he's being, especially in the latter points of the film, being criticized by the younger wing, which views him as too moderate, being criticized by the moderate wing because of his opposition to Vietnam, being, you know, surveilled as every movement is being seen and observed by the federal government. He has that complicated relationship with Lyndon B. Johnson. And then in the midst of this, you know, half the country hates him and, you know, a significant portion of it was looking forward to his death and attempting to orchestrate and organize social reform in the context of that was just an unbelievable feat for me.
It's mind-boggling that he had so much on his shoulders. And you can see in the film, there's a certain weariness that seems to set in as you see King going from year to year to year. You know, I mean, talk about multitasking, dealing with so much. It's amazing. None of us ever considered that.
Mm. Do you think the FBI had anything to do with King's assassination? And is that something that people you talked to for the film believe?
When I was a young man, I always bought into the idea it was a one-man thing, you know, that killed King. But now as I've gotten older and done a lot of films about the movement, I'm of the mind that it was conspiratorial, that there were more people involved, and possibly the FBI could have been involved. Who knows, man? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know.
Was this something that other people might kind of say to you off camera, or something people whisper to you?
Nobody said. The only person who even hinted that it was not James Earl Ray, it was Andy Young.
Andrew Young?
But he wouldn't go any further when I pushed him. So what did you mean, Reverend Young? And he said he didn't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
No one else ever said anything about it at all.
So what about now? Do you think that this kind of surveillance or overreach is possible, or that if we had significant figures in Black life, that there would be institutional mechanisms that would prevent this from happening again?
The cynical part of me, July, says, you know, and particularly with the world we live in today, everything is being surveilled. We're being recorded. We're being watched. We're being monitored. If the FBI was doing it back then, they're still doing it today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a true believer that within organizations like the Black Lives Matter movement, there's informants. You know, there's people who are providing information to the FBI.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. You know, I think it's notable that the FBI report that was leaked, about 2 years ago now, said that they were concerned about the rise of a quote-unquote Black identity extremist movement.
Yeah.
Although later in the report, they concede that they don't actually know anyone that fits that description or falls into that category. And it seems that they're just alarmed about the idea, I presume.
Yeah. Well, I bet you they're monitoring people on a daily basis.
You know, King is seen as a respected figure now. Hoover would have been thought of as a villain. I guess, what does that say about the history that has intervened between the time that you cover in this film and our contemporary moment?
You know, I grew up at a time where the notion of being an American was, even as a person of color, to forget who you were, where you came from, and become part of this so-called American melting pot, right? Now people understand that you can hold on to your identity. You can still be an American, but you can challenge many of the things that America says they're about. Now, sometimes that challenging can lead to people saying that this election that we just had, you know, of Joe Biden was fraudulent. Sometimes that challenge can make you say, well, this is what I thought of J. Lew and the FBI back in the 60s, but this is what I understand about them today and the federal government. You know, so what's happening in America, for good or bad, is people question and challenge everything about what America is supposed to be.
Power for poor people will really mean having the ability, the togetherness, the assertiveness, and the aggressiveness to make the power structure of this nation say yes when they may be desirous of saying no. Black people, Mexican Americans, American Indians, Puerto Ricans, Appalachian whites, all working together to solve the problem of poverty.
The film MLK FBI is out in theaters and available on demand. We heard director Sam Pollard speaking with staff writer Jelani Cobb. And the FBI's tapes of Dr. King are going to be made public in 2027. I'm David Remnick. Have a good week and stay safe. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.